Welcome to the latest edition of Wax Ecstatic. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Thank you so much for joining us as we once again look around through the pile of cards. Yeah, we're not in the big old monster box, and we're really not in the big old binder this time. No, we're looking at team sets. And I have one in particular that I'm going to go through. This is really more of a chance to kind of laugh back at the memories I have of a god-awful 2002 Tampa Bay Devil Rays team, thanks in part to the cards that I have from them. So we will do that in this episode and also look back at some of your favorite minor league cards as we make the transition from Big Old Monster Box to Big Old Binder. So we have minor league cards last podcast. We've got team sets this podcast. And we'll be taking a look at, I've decided to do two topics in the next podcast, which will be coming your way Friday. And that is the no-logo cards. And I found some pretty interesting no-logo cards in my collection, including the ubiquitous collectibooks. Remember those from the 80s? So we'll have some collectibooks, we'll have some no-logo cards, but also I've decided, just rummaging through this little card that is, or rummaging through this box that is appropriately titled Miscellaneous, because I just couldn't find the right words for the cards that were in this box. So if it didn't fit somewhere, it ended up in this little box of mine. But I found some cards, the old Topps All-Star Glossy cards. You normally got them through the rack packs in the mid to late 80s, but sometimes you could send in for them through, you know, you collected like 20 wrappers or whatever. Or what was often the case was those boxes of 250 assorted, quote unquote, vintage baseball cards that were really all just, you know, 88 tops. They would throw in a few of these all-star cards. So I've got the glamorous, glossy all-star cards from the 1980s. We'll take a look at those as well. First, let's take a look at what you're talking about at our Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains. And you're talking about a lot. And thank you for responding to my call to share your favorite minor league cards with us, because we've got quite a few pretty interesting ones. We'll start off with Chris Starr here. The Iowa Cubs, I don't know what year this is, but it's a trainer card for the Iowa Cubs, probably just looking at probably mid-80s, I'm guessing. First of all, it's the trainer's name, Dick Cummings. I mean, what 8-year-old kid doesn't laugh at Dick Cummings? It's like Rusty Kuntz and Pete LeCocq. So Dick Cummings, as if that poor guy wasn't cursed enough with a weird name. He's also roughly 400 pounds, and he's wearing these smoky aviator glasses. He's balding. If there was a nickname for Dick Cummings that wasn't NC-17 rated, it would be goiter. I mean, this guy is, you could just tell he's just a big guy, probably eats a lot of cheese fries, chili cheese fries. May even sweat spaghetti sauce, for all we know. But poor Dick Cummings looks like a young and dashing Steve Bannon in this card. So thank you very much, Chris, for sharing that one. Sleep Frank with an interesting minor league card. This is actually a Bowman Chrome card, so I guess we'll count this as a minor league card. Joe Jackson, Texas Rangers catching prospect. So, of course, Shoeless Joe, I guess, although I can see he's got one on his left foot. I don't know about his right foot, but half Shoeless Joe Jackson coming to a ballpark in Arlington near you. Dub Mentality, a Ron Gant collector, sends us this card of Ron Gant. BYN Cards was the manufacturer. An 88 Puerto Rican League card. How cool is that? Puerto Rican League, really cool logo here. I wish I could see the name of the team. Looks like they basically just took the Cincinnati Reds. Well, clearly they took their Cincinnati Reds hat, but also the road jersey design. So there's Ron Gant wearing number 22 in the Puerto Rican League from 1988. That is a great find. And Dub Mentality also shares a nice picture of him with Ron Gant at some kind of a fan fest activity, it looks like. So thank you very much for sharing that. Also coming in from the minor league card collection from the Funny Name File, our friends at Baseball Card Backs decide to share with us one of the 1990 CMC Pro cards. Steve Schartz. Ooh, yeah. playing with Scranton Wilkes-Barre, which at the time was the Phillies, AAA affiliate in the International League. Steve Schartz, or his baseball card back says, whoa, TMI. Now, I responded back that Steve Schartz was unfortunately given the card number 9, which I don't think is appropriate. If the people at CMC were paying any attention, they would have given him number 2. I mean, let's be honest here. If you're going to have a guy named Schartz, it's got to be number 2. Josh Olson. It should come as no surprise to anyone who knows me that this is my favorite minor league card, and it's a 1983 Fritch Madison Muskies Jose Canseco. And this is a thing of beauty. First of all, the Madison Muskies, they were in the Midwest League, and the Midwest League had a great logo back in the early 80s. It was a relief map, basically, of Iowa, Wisconsin, and Illinois, with these goofy curly Q letters MWL running down the middle. And here's Jose Canseco in a pasture somewhere in Madison, Wisconsin, leaning on one knee, wistfully looking off to the horizon, going, son of a bitch, get me out of this town. Wearing the Madison Muskies jersey, which is very similar to the Athletics jersey of the early 80s, the gold top with the green Madison across the top, kind of arced. Nice green and gold with a white letter M cap. And Jose's got the mullet going here. He's probably thinking, you know, my family escaped from Cuba so I could live the American dream, and here I am in Madison, Wisconsin. And I've never been to Madison, and with all due respect to anybody from Madison who's listening to this podcast, Madison, Wisconsin in 1983, just based on this picture, it just seems like there's a lot of Gran Torinos, a lot of Gran Torinos covered with White Castle wrappers in the back seat, and a lot of 38 Special playing on the radios of those Gran Torinos. That's just the vibe I get from 1983 Madison Muskies Jose Canseco. But poor Jose, I would love, as much as being in the same room as Jose Canseco would probably drive me up the wall, I would also, I have to admit, I would be fascinated in the sense that I would just want to talk to him about his years in Madison. Because here's this superstar in the making having to pay his dues in Madison, Wisconsin in 1983. So tell me, Jose, what does one do in Madison, Wisconsin on a Tuesday night after the 12 o'clock game with 36 people in attendance? The Snorting Bull sharing several cards with us here, including Brian Jordan of the Louisville Redbirds. That was also one of the line drive cards from 1991, much like the sheet of line drive cards that I had. Now, he also shares a sheet of cards. Where did this come from? Bob's Camera. So this was a, you know, locally produced set, as I mentioned in that podcast. A lot of minor league card sets, especially prior to, I'd say, 1988-89, were produced by just a local company or an advertiser. So Bob's Camera with a solo shot here for the Richmond Braves, Deion Sanders. This is actually 1991, so this probably would have been one of the last locally financed and sponsored cards. So you have a Bob's Camera, but also a pretty noticeable Doritos logo on this card, as well as several other logos on here. So again, a few businesses coming together in Richmond to help fund this. So that's the solo card. The single card here, I have the Mayagüez Indios. I am assuming, oh, here we go, Puerto Rican Winter League. And the Indians had, or Indios, I should say, had some pretty cool uniforms for the 89-90 Winter League season here. So thank you very much for sharing those right up there with the Puerto Rican League. Wax Pack 916, I have to rep my local AAA club, the Buffalo Bisons. He shares a couple from 1988, Dorn Taylor. And one of my favorite players because he was just one of those 4A guys. He went back and forth between Buffalo and Pittsburgh. Tom Prince, the catcher. Thank you for sharing those. Also, a very interesting one here from Tony Burbs. My favorite minor league card has to be this Oakland Oak Hard Not to Love Super Vintage Oddballs from 1947. Gene Lillard of the Oakland Oaks. That is a great find, and that goes back to the very beginning of the conversation about the minor league cards. They do go back. The earliest known one is 1940, the Sacramento Solons. So this is a great find that you have. Not only is it oddball because you have Oakland Oaks, but 1947, this would be one of the first minor league baseball card sets that came out. And this was truly, even though I can only see the front of the card, this is truly local and probably sponsored, if not by the team. Maybe there was a local shop or restaurant that put money into it and you know, have it on their back there. But yeah, this is a prime example of regional. You know, the other cards that we shared, you could buy them en masse later on because it was the late 80s and early 90s. But I'm sure outside of Oakland, you did not see too many Gene Lillard Oakland Oaks cards floating around in 1947. And finally, a comment from Ryan Caldwell, one of our newest listeners, catching up on series 1988 Fleer. Wanted more love for Will Clark for Hall of Fame, especially after Jack Morris analysis. Great show. Well, thank you very much, Ryan. You know, it seems so long ago we did the Will Clark one, 1988 Fleer, as you mentioned. And, you know, Will Clark was one of those guys who, you know, I really don't think got the really got the attention that he deserved. And I mentioned part of it was, unfortunately, throughout his career, he was linked to Rafael Palmeiro, not in a steroid sense, but, you know, they were teammates at Mississippi State. They were always compared to one another. One would follow the other by pure chance. You know, Palmeiro leaves Texas, Clark goes to Texas. Palmeiro leaves Baltimore, Clark goes to Baltimore. It just seemed like wherever Palmeiro went, Will Clark would eventually follow in his footsteps there. But I really think he's a guy that should be considered for the Hall of Fame. You look at his career numbers, 303, 284 home runs, 1,205 RBI, a pretty consistent player who unfortunately, as his career went on, got broken down by injuries quite a bit, especially by the mid-90s. He had a pretty good 1998 season, but wasn't able to put together complete seasons after or shortly before. So his overall career numbers suffer. And one of the great things about baseballreference.com, as you all well know, is, you know, the similarity score. And I always like to look at similar players to players that I'm talking about and how many Hall of Famers line up with that player. So you see a guy like Edgar Martinez, who I think should be in the Hall of Fame. Unfortunately, he gets the rap of, well, he was just a designated hitter. Well, Edgar Martinez was a designated hitter by force. It's because he tore up his knee in 1992. He was actually an all-star third baseman for the Mariners. But once he rehabbed his knee, he wasn't quite the same. So they figured, well, we can't use him out on the field. His range is considerably lessened because of this injury. Let's at least keep him for his bat. And he had a hell of a career there. So Edgar Martinez is on the cusp of Hall of Fame. You look at other players in this top 10 list, guys like John Olerud, Paul O'Neill, Matt Holliday, you know, Moises Alou. You know, there's some pretty interesting names that are in there. But I think they fall in that same basket as Tim Raines. Now, Tim Raines finally got into the Hall of Fame this upcoming summer. He'll be inducted. But he was one of those guys that was really good, had a very long, sustainable career. But when you look at just what the parameters are for Hall of Fame, he didn't quite meet up to them. I think Will Clark will get into the Hall of Fame at some point in time. I think it's more of a Veterans Committee vote, unfortunately, for him. But he's definitely a guy that I think you have to consider, because if you put it in context, in the 80s and 90s, especially when he was with San Francisco, that guy could mash. He was a leader on and off the field. Granted, he was a red ass. He was very high strung. But this was a guy who, especially, you know, when you had Clark and Matt Williams back to back in that lineup, it was almost like Canseco and McGuire. I think Canseco and McGuire had more raw power than Clark and Williams, but I would have to say, and it's unique because they were in the same area at the same time, I would put that duo up against any other slugging duo from the late 80s in particular. And dare you to match it. Now, you can probably find some that are equal to it, or maybe there's one even better that I'm just not thinking of off the top of my head, but I would definitely put that duo up there. So Will Clark, great player. I just think he's one of those guys that, boy, the planets and stars would really have to align for him to get in there. Now, to your point, Jack Morris, and if you want to listen to our argument about Jack Morris in the Hall of Fame, 86 Tops podcast, that's the one we did it on back in, I think it was episode 29. I am a big, big believer that Jack Morris should be in the Hall of Fame, not only because of a win total and, you know, number of World Series he won, but, you know, this was also a guy going back to complete games. You're never going to have a pitcher put up the complete game numbers like Jack Morris. And Jack Morris didn't always lead the league in complete games. He might have 20 complete games in a season, and he wasn't first in the major leagues. Nowadays, because of how specialization has taken over pitching staffs, at the end of the season, you're lucky if you get one pitcher to 10 complete games. So, you know, having players be durable enough to not only pitch 20 or so complete games throughout a season and have a career that goes 15, 16, 17, 18 years like Jack Morris. And he was pretty good. I mean, he had his down years, but, you know, Jack Morris was pretty, you know, dependable for much of his career. I think if there's one thing that holds, well, there's two things that hold Jack Morris down. One is he didn't hit 300 wins, but the other is, you know, his earned run average is a little inflated. Part of that is playing in Tiger Stadium in the 80s, but also, you know, he was a guy that wasn't going to wow you with a 98 mile an hour fastball, but he had enough in his arsenal to baffle a lot of batters and be the ace pitcher for that Tiger staff throughout the 80s and be a key contributor, no doubt about it, to the 91 Twins, but also the 92 Blue Jays. And, you know, this guy was money. You could count on him to deliver a big game when necessary. So, you know, and I know he had some off the field issues, which we discussed in that podcast, a lot of feminism issues, to put it nicely. But I think, you know, Jack Morris has to get into the Hall of Fame. I would put Jack Morris in front of Will Clark, but that's not saying Will Clark doesn't deserve to be in the Hall. So that's my two cents. If you want to comment on that, or if you have more minor league cards you want to share, feel free to do so on our Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains. All right, team sets. I love team sets, and there's really two types of team sets. One is the one that the actual team puts out. And often in the past, that would be in the form of like 5x8 glossy black and white photos, or sometimes 8x10, and they would give you a space to get it signed. But I mean, those are photos. Those aren't necessarily cards. So sometimes a team would put out a card set, but most of the time, and especially more recently, you're looking at they would co-op with, if not one of the major card manufacturers, then they would co-op with a major sponsor of theirs to produce the cards. So, for example, you know, the Chicago Cubs, I know back in like the 80s, they would team up with Edie's Ice Cream. You know, Edie's was a regional brand, big sponsor for the Cubs. So they would team up and then they would put together a card set. Now, you couldn't necessarily buy these card sets at the ballpark. You couldn't buy them certainly at a grocery store, but there were different ways of acquiring them. Now, for an example, with Edie's Ice Cream, let's say, if you mailed in a box top or if you sent Edie's, you know, $5, you would get a coupon for Edie's plus the card set. Maybe they would have a co-op with the grocery store. Okay, if you buy Edie's at Kroger, then you get this complimentary card set. So sometimes you had those two or three step ways of getting that stuff. Not all that different from back in the 70s and 80s, you could get drinking glasses with your favorite NFL team logo if you filled up with 10 gallons of gas at your local gas station. I still have, you know, even though as cheesy as that sounds, I know my family still has gas station drinking glasses from, you know, 40 years ago sitting in their, my parents do, they have that sitting in their kitchen cabinets. So, you know, that's one way of doing it. But the more likely way was you would have a sponsor co-op with a team, or a team would co-op with one of the major card companies. They would produce a card set and they would give them away at a game. And then any leftover sets, they would, you know, put on sale at the team store or hand out to, you know, local businesses. And, you know, you could walk into a restaurant, there'd be a stack of these up at the cash register and you could get them there. So one set that I wanted to look at, and in particular because I remember this team well, I remember the players well, I remember the situation well, it's the 2002 Tampa Bay Devil Rays. Now, in 2002, I was not really actively collecting cards again. I had given up the hobby, you know, buying new cards at least, you know, after the 93 season. I'd never really got back into it. You know, it was another 11, 12 years afterwards before I started buying new packs. So I went to a Rays game, and I loved going to the old Devil Rays games because tickets, you could find them anywhere. In fact, that reminds me once. So the radio station I worked for at the time, you could get free tickets because they were the flagship station of the Devil Rays. And there were stacks of tickets like on our secretary's desk. And if you wanted them, you just picked them up and went to the game. So one day, a friend of mine and I, we were going to have a couple other friends meet us up at the ballpark, and we would go in and watch the game. Now, we were able to get club-level seats. Now, the club level at Tropicana Field, not exactly something to go out of your way for back then. And I didn't care. Hey, I'm going to a baseball game. I'm not paying for the tickets. I'm on the club level, and I'm going to invite a few friends. Well, lo and behold, one of my friends, he and his friend, couldn't make it. So just me and my other friends. So I'm like, crap, I've got two tickets. They're club level. I don't want them to go to waste. So I distanced myself far enough from the box office, and I kind of hold these tickets up. And I'm clearly, you know, doing something I shouldn't be doing on Tropicana Field property. But I'm standing in front of the grand walkway where most of the fans enter the ballpark, and I'm just holding up these two tickets. And I couldn't tell you how many people laughed at me. It's like, oh, wait, you think someone's going to buy those, huh? And even I had one guy come up to me and says, you know, out of morbid curiosity, how much are you selling? I said, just $5, you know. For me, it was just beer money. I didn't want these tickets to go to waste. Here's $5, buy these seats. And of course, nobody bought the seats. And that's because in 2002, nobody, well, okay, a handful of people bought seats to see the Tampa Bay Devil Rays. The Devil Rays in 2002, that was their fifth season. And with expansion teams, historically, the fifth season is where the team starts turning the corner and starts heading up. Now, the notable exceptions are the Arizona Diamondbacks and the Florida Marlins. Now, the big reasons why they're exceptions, when the Diamondbacks started, they went with the complete opposite approach as the Rays did. The Devil Rays were going to start with veterans, build up a farm system, and then bring all these prospects up and have this great team one day. Well, that was the plan. The Diamondbacks said, no, we're going to go out and we're going to acquire Randy Johnson and Curt Schilling and Luis Gonzalez. They just spent money out the wazoo, and it worked for them. They won the World Series in 2001. And then the Marlins, of course, they started with the traditional expansion franchise experiment. But Wayne Huizenga, looking to win now and sell the ball club, of course, we all know the big spend going into the 1997 season, and it worked for them. They won the 97 World Series. But that team was broken up in 1998, and you know, the Diamondbacks hadn't even been remotely close to, you know, being a contender shortly after that 2001 World Series. So the Devil Rays are very much in line in 2002 with the Mets and the Royals and the Blue Jays. Let me see who else from that. You know, the Pilots / Brewers, you know, and even the Expos, you know, the expansion teams, once they got to their fifth year, and they had some pretty bad, especially like the third and fourth years of expansion teams are traditionally just awful, you know, 108 loss type seasons. But normally by the fifth year, you've got some prospects, you found a couple diamonds in the rough in terms of veterans, and you've got a direction and it's starting to go upwards with the idea that by year 7, 8, 9, 10, whatever, you're contending, you're winning, etc. Well, the Devil Rays were not one of those teams. They were kind of in that position, but they would never leave that position. as long as one Vincent J. Namoli owned the team. Now, Vince Namoli in Tampa Bay, those are two dirty words. They should not be. Vince Namoli should actually be seen as a hero. There should be a statue of Vince Namoli outside of Tropicana Field. But here's why that isn't. Vince Namoli ruled with an iron fist. He was a businessman who was buying into sports. Not all that different from George Steinbrenner, you know, a guy who ran, his business, his shipbuilding business, very, very sternly, no pun intended, and tried to do the same thing with the Yankees. Vince Namoli, who had Anchor Glass as his business, ran that with an iron fist, tried to do the same thing with baseball, and it didn't go over well. But when you look back at the story of how Vince got the team, he really should be looked back at in Tampa Bay with a little more reverence. It's probably still too soon, but I think over time people will realize this. If you don't know, Tampa and St. Pete were battling for much of the 1980s. Who's going to build a stadium first and who's going to get a Major League Baseball team first? Finally, St. Petersburg moved forward. They built what is now Tropicana Field. Then it was the Florida Suncoast Dome. And even though Peter Uberoth and Bart Giamatti and Bud Selig, you know, everybody along the line said, don't build the ballpark. Well, they built the ballpark. So St. Petersburg won the race in who's going to build the ballpark first, but it sat empty. You had concerts there. The Tampa Bay Lightning played three seasons there. You had the occasional football game there. But there was no major league team that was going to move there. They were always using St. Petersburg and the Florida Suncoast Dome as a pawn in getting a better stadium deal back home. The Chicago White Sox did that. The Baltimore Orioles did that. The Seattle Mariners did that. Countless teams, and now I'm kind of going off on a wider spectrum, the Blue Jays did it. The A's did it. The Rangers did it. A lot of teams would use Tampa Bay as a pawn. Hey, we're going to move to Florida. And then, you know, the local legislators would get their act together and suddenly build a new stadium. So the three teams that came closest were the White Sox, the Orioles, and the Mariners. Then came the San Francisco Giants. The Giants, who were losing money, playing in that dump at Candlestick, and it's hard to compete with two teams in the Oakland-San Francisco Bay Area. Well, they were losing out to Oakland. Remember, the A's were at the King of the Hill back in the early 90s. Even though the Giants played in the 89 World Series, they were falling fast. They were losing money. And the ownership was not finding any luck in a buyer, in a stadium deal, nothing. So Vince Namoli had a purchase agreement to buy the Giants and move them to St. Petersburg. Well, Bud Selig, and in particular the National League, would have none of that. So long story short, the National League nixes the deal. Giants aren't moving to Tampa Bay. The Giants are not only staying in San Francisco with local ownership. Oh, look, we found money to sign some guy named Barry Bonds. And, you know, Barry hits a lot of home runs, and all of a sudden we found the resources to build this world-class ballpark on the waterfront, and the rest, and a couple of World Series later, as they say, is history. Well, Vince is rightly steamed. He had a deal in place, and he had followed every check and balance to make sure that the deal was right. But the National League nixes it. Major League Baseball goes along with it. Vince Namoli sues Major League Baseball. Well, what do you know? We're going to expand in 1998. Well, that's crazy. Where would we come up with such a wild idea? So come 1998, the Tampa Bay Devil Rays and the Arizona Diamondbacks are born. So Vince ran things with an iron fist, and the excitement of baseball in Tampa Bay. And yes, there was excitement in 1998. It went away very, very quickly, not only because the team wasn't that good, not only because the stadium certainly wasn't that good, and you think Tropicana Field is bad now. I have to give Stuart Sternberg credit for at least sprucing the place up and giving it a little bit of life as they look for their next ballpark, because Tropicana Field 15 years ago was just a mausoleum. It was a terrible place to watch a ball game. So you have the bad ballpark, you have the bad team, and then you have the overbearing owner. And if you just look up Vince Namoli, you'll see all sorts of stories about shenanigans that he played, little hissy fits that he had, vengeance that he had against people who detracted against him, et cetera, et cetera. So come 2002, you've got a Devil Rays team that had so much promise, but just could not deliver. So with that, let's take a look at this 2002 Tampa Bay Devil Rays team set that I have. And you'll see the first card is all about Tropicana. Tropicana's 2002 starting lineup. And if you were to flip the card over, and I don't have a picture of this to share with you, but you know, it's basically an advertisement for the Tropicana juice lineup. And of course, their name is on the field, so they are a major sponsor. And as I'm looking through these cards, I'm thinking, wow, these are actually pretty decent cards. The front's cool. The back is cool. And, you know, I do have a picture. I pulled all the pictures together to make one big, like, sheet, if you will. But, you know, you had this glossy card, good card stock. And I thought, they really actually put together a decent card set here. And then I look at the bottom and it says, copyright 2002 Tampa Bay Devil Rays, all rights reserved, printed in the USA, sponsored by Tropicana. And that's where I went, aha, Vince Namoli probably didn't pay a dime for these. This was all Tropicana getting their name out there and putting a nice little product in the hands of the 4,000 people who bothered to show up on baseball card night. So, all right, with that said, Tropicana deserves the starting lineup card at the top of the set. So then we look through these cards, and these were organized alphabetically. So I'm going to go through them alphabetically. One of the first cards that jumped out at me, Nick Bierbrot. What a great name. Bierbrot. And I remember fans around here were going, could you ask for a better sports name than Bierbrot? And Nick Bierbrot was a young pitcher, a left-handed pitcher, so all of a sudden he's more valuable than anybody else on the team. But also, Nick Bierbrot was a guy who got the blessing of Randy Johnson. He was acquired in a trade with the Diamondbacks. And Randy Johnson had some very nice things to say about Nick Bierbrot. So all of a sudden it's like, Randy Johnson likes him. This guy is the real deal. And unfortunately, Nick Bierbrot did not live up to the expectations. Now, with that said, if you look at the front of the card here, you'll see it says at the top, Tampa Bay Devil Rays. You have the old Rays logo right in the middle. You have the action shot of Nick Bierbrot throwing a pitch. You have his name vertically from bottom to top and his uniform number and position. But also superimposed kind of in the background, you see this grid and this little heart line, this little EKG line at the bottom. And on the right, it says Heart and Hustle. That was the ad campaign for the Rays in 2002. Heart and Hustle. Well, you could get Heart most of the games. Hustle, they didn't hustle too much. That was pretty much all the Rays could sell back in 2002 was the potential for Heart and Hustle, because that team was a terrible team. They had a record that season of 55 wins and 106 losses. So even on Heart and Hustle, they couldn't deliver 100%. I remember one year they had their ad slogan was Rays Ball, be part of it, which doesn't really sell tickets. But it's a little more truthful than Heart and Hustle because we didn't see it that much. Now, case in point as to a lack of heart and hustle, our next card, Ben Grieve. Oh, what an absolute slug this guy was. Ben Grieve was another acquisition. It was a three-way deal with Colorado and Oakland. So Ben Grieve, who had put up some decent numbers with Oakland a few years prior, comes to Tampa Bay and everyone's like, here is our big star for the outfield. Look at what he did in Oakland. Ben Grieve, this is a big deal. And believe it or not, it sounds funny these days, but when he was acquired, it was big news. Ben Grieve is coming to the Devil Rays. Here's a guy who's on the up and up. Well, it turned out Ben Grieve was extremely, extremely lazy. And despite the fact that he put up some very nice numbers for the A's in 99 and 2000, he had a season in 2001 that didn't necessarily grab the headlines. You know, he was batting about the same, you know, mid-260s, but his home run production was down, his RBI production was down. He just didn't really fit in that well. And then come 2002, here comes Lou Piniella as the manager, and there was a legendary outburst in, I want to say it was 2002, where, you know, Ben Grieve was just kind of slouching around in the dugout and Lou's going on one of his rants. And, you know, Lou just started picking on Ben Grieve. And when Lou picked on somebody, he didn't just pick on him. He hammered him like whack-a-mole. And everybody loved it because Ben Grieve was clearly not what he promised to be. And I have a shot of the back of his card just to show you what the basic card of the set looked like. And you had the player name in the upper left-hand corner, the team headshot just left of center. Personal information to the right, the Rays logo, and I'm a sucker for that old logo. I love that old logo. I mean, I like what the Rays look has been since 2008, but I'm one of the few people that like the old green and black Rays logo and uniform. There's not enough green in sports uniforms, but I liked it. So long live the old Rays logo. I hope somehow, some way it gets resurrected, but probably not under the current ownership as they tried to shy away from as much as they could with the old regime. But underneath the career stats, you had the interesting statistics here, interesting stories. And of course, Ben Grieve was the son of Tom Grieve, who had a very good, not only playing career, not great, but a decent playing career, but also career management as well. So let's move on. The next card I found interesting, Toby Hall. Toby Hall was one of the few quote-unquote stars of this team. He had a pretty good bat when he didn't strike out. He ground into double plays a lot. But he was a heart and soul leader for this team, as much as you could find on that team back then. He was also a very stocky guy, and I remember once he somehow hit, I think, a triple. And as he's hustling around the bases, he pulls up at third, and everyone's excited because, oh my God, Toby Hall, who was as slow as molasses on the base path, somehow got a triple. And one of my favorite comments from Joe McGrain, who was doing the color commentary then for the Rays, he said, it's like a milk truck without brakes out there. That pretty much described Toby Hall rounding the bases. Now, one of the other stars of the Devil Rays team from that time, Aubrey Huff, this guy has been a few fries short of a Happy Meal, if you know what I mean. Even back when he was with the Rays, he was doing some really, really bizarro stuff, which came out shortly after his playing time here. I'm not going to get into the details because some of it is just quite frankly gross. He and Pat Burrell and the whole bondage thing later on. Yeah. But also, it just came out, there was a story about him trying to recover from alcohol and drug abuse. He nearly killed himself a few years ago. So I hope that he can pull himself together with that stuff. He does have some lunatic fringe comments, especially with politics. Not quite Curt Schilling, but kind of out there. And the one redeeming point of Aubrey Huff's time in Tampa Bay, he was traded to the Houston Astros for Ben Zobrist. And of course, then it seemed lopsided for the Astros, who were making a playoff push. And here's this 25-year-old second baseman in Double-A. What are we doing with this guy? And of course, we all know what happened to Ben Zobrist, not only in Tampa Bay, but with Kansas City and the Cubs shortly thereafter. Now, the next card I have here, this is a really sad story. Joe Kennedy. This was another guy who, left-handed pitcher, could throw heat, had terrible ball placement, though. This guy just could not hit the strike zone. And he was a guy who drank a lot. I remember I was actually working at the radio station in a production room, and Kennedy, and I want to say it was Beer Broad, I don't remember who the second player was, but they came in to read some liners that were going to be plugged into a commercial inside the Rays broadcast. Well, it turns out these guys had their lunch at Hooters, and they spent more time drinking beer than eating chicken wings. So they were three sheets to the wind when they came into this production studio. And what should have been just a 5 or 10 minute commercial read turned out to be a 30-minute odyssey of these drunk baseball players not being able to read a sentence. Joe Kennedy, unfortunately, died several years ago. He had a heart attack, if I recall correctly. And I remember the day where he was drunk and trying to read these liners for a broadcast. So that's not a very flattering way of remembering him. But I just remember him as a young guy with so much potential and so much talent. And he died way, way, way too young. It's so sad that he passed away at such a young age. Now, moving on to a much lighter-hearted story. The manager of the Devil Rays in the 2001 season, Hal McCray, he was also the manager in 2002. Lou Piniella would come in the start of the 2003 season. So I backtrack on my Ben Greaves story. I just remembered Lou was hired in October of 2002. And then, you know, he took over for the 2003 season and on. But Hal McRae, who, of course, had that fiery, passionate ball player attitude, was best remembered, unfortunately for him, when he was managing the Royals, for having that outburst with reporters and throwing the telephone at one of them. And that carried over. You know, he came over to Tampa Bay. He took over for Larry Rothschild. Larry was the manager, I think, midway through the 01 season. And Hal was trying to move past that telephone throwing moment in Kansas City. So he was this really calm, really laid back, just as vanilla and cardboard as you can get. And that was a detriment to the team. This is where the team, you know, this is why I said they didn't really have a whole lot of heart and hustle, because poor Hal McRae was trying to be all nice and proper and, you know, not like throwing telephones around the place. That any kind of fire and brimstone, you know, any kind of kick in the ass this team needed, he wouldn't do it. So that's one reason why Lou Piniella was brought in. Of course, Lou had family reasons. His mother was sick at the time. His daughter was in the Tampa area, so he moved back here for family reasons. But, you know, Hal McRae, this picture of him where he's just kind of standing there with his hand on his chin, this was about as animated as Hal McRae got. Not just him standing there with his hand on his chin, but as animated as a baseball card. This guy just didn't have much of a pulse throughout his time here in Tampa Bay. The next card, Tanyon Sturts, actually. That's how the late, great Chris Thomas would pronounce his name. Tanyon Sturts. This was your ace in 2002, everybody. Yay. Yeah, Tanyon Sturts was just not a very good pitcher to begin with, yet this team was just so terrible. He was the ace that year. Went an incredible 4-18 over 33 starts and had a 5.18 earned run average. That's all you need to know about Tanyon Sturts in 2002. Since then, much like Aubrey Huff, he's kind of gone lunatic fringe on some political points. And to which I look at him and go, you weren't a very good pitcher. I don't take your commentary worth a grain of salt. But yeah, Tanyon Sturts, that one kind of brought back some funny memories. Randy Wynn, who was an all-star for the team, pretty decent outfielder, not a great outfielder, but he was actually traded for Lou Piniella. So there's your trivia answer right there. Name the Devil Rays player that was traded for the rights to negotiate a contract with Lou Piniella. And that would be Randy Wynn, who went on to Seattle and then I believe San Francisco afterwards, had a pretty decent career. The next card, Victor Zambrano, talk about trades. We were so happy. This was one of the few trades that Chuck Lamar got right. Trading Victor Zambrano in the middle of the 2004 season for Scott Kazmir, as the Mets were just totally in over their head, taking on a very average at best pitcher in Zambrano for Scott Kazmir. Of course, Scotty K had a few solid seasons here, nearly derailed his career after going to Oakland and to the Angels, and then was able to revive it over the last couple seasons. So good for him. All right, a couple more cards here. The future stars. Yes. This is how Chuck Lamar kept his job for so many years. He was able to keep promising the future players. And you have Josh Hamilton, Carl Crawford, and Rocco Baldelli. Boy, Josh Hamilton, such a sad story. You know, a first-round draft pick. The Rays could have had several other really good players at their command in 1999, but they went with Josh Hamilton. And, of course, you know the story of Hamilton. Had some helicopter parents, was revolting a little bit, and while he was in the minor leagues, got hooked on drugs, you know, tattoos all over his body, in and out of rehab numerous times, and finally the Rays had to cut ties with him in, I think it was 2006. Well, the Cincinnati Reds pick him up, and of course he has this banner year for the Reds, so even though it was new regime for the Rays that decided to cut him loose, all of a sudden, he's a stud in Cincinnati and, of course, had some quality years with the Texas Rangers. And again, has been having some issues staying sober, so I hope the best for him. I want to skip over to Rocco Baldelli. Baldelli's another one, first-round draft pick, who was going to be the next Ted Williams. I mean, this guy was going to be the next great ball player, was a huge star in Woonsocket, Rhode Island, was going to set the world on fire with his play, but had numerous injuries and a mysterious illness that sidelined his playing career. He did play with the Rays through, I think, 2006, went to Boston for a couple of years. He's actually now back with the Rays as a base coach. So, you know, Rocco, that was a tough story, too, because so much potential and talent, but injuries and then again some health issues sidelining his career, was never able to live up to the potential, unfortunately. But he was such a good guy. Great to see him back in town with the team. And then the guy in the middle, Carl Crawford. It's funny, you know, after the Lightning retired Marty St. Louis jersey a couple months ago, somebody said, well, who would you retire for the Rays? And that's a tough question to answer because the Rays have never really had any players who have been around long enough to justify a jersey retirement. I know some people say Evan Longoria, while Longo's a key piece to this team. I don't know if yet in his career he's reached the jersey retirement level. So the more I thought about it, I said, well, it would probably be Carl Crawford, because Crawford was with the team, I think, from 01 through, what was it, 2010, I want to say. If you squint hard enough, there's Ricky Henderson in there. He had speed, not the explosive speed that Henderson had. He had a great bat. This guy could hit for power. And, you know, he was a pretty reliable fielder, too. The problem is, years of playing on the Tropicana field, just turf, you know, that just took the life out of his knees. And even he knew it. You know, in the last couple of years he was in Tampa Bay, he's just like, you know, this is just shortening my career. Well, then he signs that big deal with the Boston Red Sox. And it's bad enough that the Rays can't afford or don't want to pay, what did he get paid in Boston, like $18 million. So it's one thing that you can't match up to the Red Sox payroll. It's another thing that your star outfielder is signing with an intra-division rival. But really the knife in the back from Carl Crawford was at his introductory press conference, where he says, my heart is in Boston. And I got to tell you, that killed us here in Tampa. Really? Are you kidding me? I mean, hey, good for you. You're with the Red Sox. You're in a major market. You're making big bucks. Yay. But don't sit there and go, my heart is in Boston. I mean, our heart was with you for so many years. You were the one good guy we could hang on to. So that hurt. Well, you know, Crawford, as you know, the media in Boston, much more tougher on players than here in Tampa. The fans, much more tougher on players in Boston. And then the injury issues, which did come around. And all of a sudden, not only were the Red Sox bad, but Crawford was having a whale of a time trying to produce anything close to what he did in Tampa Bay. So I have to admit, and I'm a little ashamed of this, but as the Rays were still contending and the Red Sox were descending, as was Crawford, at least we knew his heart was in Boston. And of course, he went to Los Angeles, and his career's pretty much hit the end there. Now, there's also this plain white card that just has the Rays logo on it. I don't know if that's just because they need an autograph card or they didn't have enough good players. But there you go. There's a plain white card in the set. And finally, Tropicana Field, home of the Devil Rays, lit up in orange, celebrating a victory, one of the rare ones that they had back in 2002. And I've already made my statement about Tropicana Field, nay, Florida Suncoast Dome, Thunderdome for a few years when the Lightning played there. But that is your 2002 Tampa Bay Devil Rays, or a small selection of them. So it was a really nice card. Like, this was probably the first time since I got that pack of cards 15 years ago. This is probably the first time that I've actually opened them up and looked at them. They were actually really nice cards. And if you get the right sponsor, you can get some really nice cards. It's not like the hokey cards from the 70s and 80s. These were some really nice cards, but clearly Tropicana, you know, paid for the load here. But it's really funny looking at these cards, not only because for 2002, they were actually probably better than some of the cards that were nationally produced. But looking back at some of those names and some of the stories, wow. I know the Rays, you know, they're struggling now. They're not going to be, more than likely, they're not going to be anything like they were from 2008 through, what was it, 2013, when they had their little run. but the Devil Rays back in 2002. Let me just sum it up to you this way. Out of morbid curiosity, how much are you selling those tickets for? That's pretty much it. The Devil Rays back then could have run a promotion. The first 10,000 fans get three empty seats to sit next to, because that was pretty much the case every night. So if you have a favorite team set, major league or minor league, feel free to share it on Wax and Gum Stains, our Twitter feed, and look forward to our next podcast on Friday. Again, we're going to do a twofer here, as we're going to look at the no logo cards. I do have a few of those that I want to share, but also the glossy all-star cards from Topps. Some pretty interesting cards. Also a gem that I'm going to throw in there, Boardwalk and Baseball. I've got a handful of Boardwalk and Baseball cards. If you didn't get to go to Boardwalk and Baseball before they shut the doors there in, I think it was 1990, they closed down, you missed out. Long live Boardwalk and Baseball. And long live Wax Ecstatic. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. We'll see you Friday on our next episode. Thanks for joining us once again.